act upon its object and purpose to ensure that international crimes committed against Palestinians do not go unpunished.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio.
The Iranian foreign minister says the U.S. needs to fulfill its commitments to the Iran nuclear deal if it wants to return to the international accord. The UK and the EU agreed to decide by Sunday whether their Brexit talks are worth continuing as the two sides remain far apart on a future trade deal. Also coming up, Brazil reports over 53,000 additional confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus, the highest daily increase since mid-August. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters in the rainy capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the Islamic Republic is ready for the return of the U.S. to the 2015 nuclear deal.
We are ready for the return of the U.S. to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action so that Washington can earn its last privilege. However, the U.S. should implement its commitments in order to earn the privilege of being part of the JCPOA. I'm not saying this is impossible, but the U.S. should not be the one to put forward conditions. I'm not pessimistic about the future. Why? Not because of trusting the U.S., but because of the failure of its maximum pressure campaign.
Zarif said, however, that Iran's missile program is non-negotiable, and conditioning this to the U.S.'s return to the JCPOA is out of the question. He described the nuclear agreement as a great achievement for Iran. The top diplomat said the deal eliminated the security threat to Iran and helped end 6 UN Security Council resolutions against the country. U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. President-elect Joe Biden's national security advisor has said the incoming U.S. administration will rejoin the nuclear pact and, quote, force Tehran to comply with the terms of the original agreement. Jake Sullivan said this means lifting sanctions and follow-on negotiation on broader issues. John Bosnich is a political analyst and joins us now out of New York. John, welcome. Why do you think Iran is insisting that this deal cannot be renegotiated?
Well, I mean, this is one of the basic rules of making a deal, especially at the international level from state to state. When a deal is negotiated, first, that deal needs to be respected. If that deal is not respected to the letter, what possible point would there be in negotiating any further follow-on terms? So we're basically building a structure here for peaceful interaction between the United States, its allies, notably Israel, and Iran. If there's going to be any kind of peaceful coexistence, it depends on the fulfillment to the letter of the existing deal. Once that's achieved, then there's a basis for future cooperation. If that can't be achieved, what possible point would there be in discussing anything for the future?
Of course, Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the JCPOA, do you foresee a Joe Biden administration rejoining the international agreement?
Well, Biden has said that he will do so. You know, over here in the United States, there's no clarity as to whether Biden is even going to take office as president. So there's a lot more up in the air than one would expect. But the point is, a deal was made, it was functioning, and it should be respected. If that deal can be used properly to achieve a peaceful resolution, that should be done. And we have to remember that Israel is itself a nuclear power, an undeclared nuclear power, that has kept one of its nuclear scientists, Mr. Vanunu, in prison in isolation for some 18 years, just for mentioning the facts about the Israeli program. So we need a little bit of fairness in international affairs, and we need a little bit more clarity about who is who and who works for who.
And Iran's John says it's there's talk of follow-on negotiation on broader issues. Iran says its defense capabilities, including its missile program, is a red line. Do you think the other signatories to the agreement will consider this fact, considering the fact that they do have missiles, including nuclear missiles, and the facts on the ground indicate that, you know, show that Iran hasn't attacked any countries, whereas the other signatories have been involved in military intervention in other countries?
In fact, you're absolutely on point there. We have to do a little bit of a history lesson here. Iran, as Persia, was an international world power. Iran has now become a relatively benign regional power. There has been no war with Iran since the Americans pushed Iraq into the war with Iran. We have a situation now where Iran has attempted to maintain its sovereignty, which every state has the right to do, to guarantee its compliance with a deal which it signed and attempted to abide by with the United States. It was not Iran which withdrew from the deal with the United States, it was the USA. So the USA first has to undo its error. When it undoes its error, then Iran can make an assessment of whether the United States is a reliable partner to move forward with. And we all know the story of North Korea, which is a nuclear-armed state and probably only still exists as an independent state today because of that fact. That's the reality of international politics, like it or not.
Okay, John, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. John Bosnich there, political analyst, joining us out of New York. And in other news, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says the bloc and Britain are far apart on Brexit trade deal, as Downing Street says very large gaps still remain. The remarks came after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson met von der Leyen in Brussels to break an impasse over a post-Brexit trade deal. The British government said that the two sides agreed to decide by Sunday whether their negotiations are worth continuing. Earlier, Johnson said no British leader could accept the current demands of the European Union. Britain formally left the bloc in January. The UK has since been in a transition period during which it remains in the EU's single market. The transition period ends on December the 31st. Jerome Hughes says British people are worried about the future of their country after Brexit.
A lot of people scratching their heads. They're wondering what actually do they really think this can achieve, especially critics of Boris Johnson. They're saying, well, you know, if this is how you can actually get a deal by having face-to-face high-level talks, well, why haven't you done it sooner? Why haven't you been in Brussels more often? A lot of people are saying as well he'd have been much better off perhaps going as a guest to the tomorrow, Thursday, and also Friday to the EU Leaders Summit here in Brussels, so we can actually speak to more of the sort of the key players in the European Union, maybe Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, you know, and so on, and maybe progress things that way. But so people are just wondering what actually will this achieve. And also following earlier today, Wednesday, following his speech in the British House of Commons, Boris Johnson, when he was talking about the type of language that he was using, has actually encouraged people like Sinn Féin, the main opposition party in the Republic of Ireland, which is sort of a key player in terms of Irish politics, saying that it's looking now more and more likely that we're not going to get a deal because of the type of language Johnson was using. He was once again saying that, we will prosper mightily with or without a deal in the UK. And you also outlined some of the issues there. He said it would be the only country in the world that wouldn't have sovereignty over its fishing waters and so on.
We're staying in Europe, where the French government has defended a controversial bill that aims to fight what it calls Islamic radicalism. President Emmanuel Macron has promoted the bill to target, quote, separatists undermining the nation. But rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate against and stigmatize French Muslims. Earlier this year, Macron, who was trying to rally support for the ban, said Islam was a religion in crisis globally. The remarks were widely criticized worldwide and led to anti-France protests. The bill in question says, among others, that any person or entity in France is obliged to respect the country's principles of secularism. It also calls for more scrutiny over funding of French mosques. Political commentator Imad Hamad says the French president's recent remarks open the doors for racism and potential acts of violence against Muslims.
What's happening in France is very alarming, simply because the effort to introduce such a bill and the president of France remarks open doors wide for racism, hate, and potential acts of violence and hate crimes to take course against people of Muslim faith. Definitely, this is not acceptable. It should not be tolerated under any circumstances. Definitely, we see this as something that does not respect, that does not reflect the French people values, nor the American values, nor the European values, nor the Muslim values. What's bad is bad, what's good is good. And not by the name of those who hijack the noble and respected faith of Islam and commit horrific crimes. That's a reason to for general condemnation and guilt by association approach against the population in France.
The International Criminal Court says it has reason to believe that British forces had committed war crimes in Iraq.
The office has previously found and today confirmed that there is a reasonable basis to believe that members of the British Armed Forces committed the war crimes of willful killing, torture, inhumane or cruel treatment, outrages upon personal dignity, and rape and or other forms of sexual violence. The office has identified a confined number of incidents to reach this determination, which, while not exhaustive, appear to correspond to the most serious allegations of violence against persons in UK custody.
A statement by the ICC chief prosecutor also said that the failure of the military command contributed to crimes by UK soldiers against detainees. It said the British Army's initial response to the crimes was inadequate and lacked impartiality or independence. Despite those findings, the ICC has decided to drop the preliminary probe, saying it concluded that British authorities examined the allegations. The decision came after the court found no evidence suggesting that the alleged perpetrators had been shielded from scrutiny in Britain. The ICC report, however, acknowledged that not a single person had been prosecuted in the UK with regard to the crimes committed in Iraq, mainly because of a lack of substantial evidence. Political commentator Cindy Sheehan says the US-led coalition's invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war crime in itself because it was imposed preemptively.
First of all, we know that before the invasion of Iraq, or I don't know if it was Afghanistan or Iraq, the U.S. withdrew from the International Criminal Court and doesn't recognize its authority. But back after World War II, the Nuremberg trials, one of the justices of the Nuremberg trials said that preemptive war is a war crime. There was no reason for the United States to, there was no valid or true reason for the United States to invade Iraq or Afghanistan. And so just invading those two countries was a war crime, and anything that happened after the invasion was a war crime because it's inherently a war crime. Now we know that it's hard to get a true count, but probably over 1 million Iraqi, thousands, tens of thousands of Afghans, innocent civilians have been killed. The war crimes continue to this day with the poisoning of the country using toxic weapons, toxic products, and things like that.
Elsewhere, Azerbaijan and Armenia have accused each other of using weapons containing white phosphorus during weeks of recent fighting for control of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Wounded servicemen and medical staff at a hospital in the Armenian capital, Yerevan, claimed the fighters had suffered burns consistent with the use of phosphorus or another chemical agent. An Azerbaijani official made a similar claim last month. Fierce clashes erupted in late September between Azerbaijan's army and separatists backed by Armenia over the mountainous region. The hostilities claimed more than 5,000 lives and ended after the two sides agreed to a Moscow-brokered peace deal in November that saw Armenian separatists cede parts of their territory. The United States has reported more than 3,000 coronavirus fatalities, the highest daily death toll since the pandemic began. The Johns Hopkins University data show the number of infections also rose by over 220,000. The United States, being the world's worst-hit country, has so far recorded more than 289,000 deaths and over 15.3 million cases. Elsewhere in the Americas region, Brazil registered more than 800 deaths and over 53,000 cases, its highest number of infections since mid-August. The Latin American nation has more than 6.7 million infections and nearly 179,000 deaths. Meanwhile, several human rights groups have warned that four countries are set to miss out on COVID-19 vaccines amid a rush by richer nations to hoard them.
The People's Vaccine Alliance, of which Oxfam is a member, have looked at all the vaccine contracts that are on the table across the globe. And we've found that unless urgent action is taken by pharmaceutical corporations and rich country governments, 9 out of 10 people in poor countries are not going to receive a vaccine next year and possibly for years to come.
The alliance, which also includes Amnesty International and Global Justice Now, said rich countries have bought enough COVID-19 vaccine doses for their populations three times over. Campaigners noted that wealthy nations have bought up to 53% of vaccines so far, while they comprise of only 14% of the global population. Rights groups called on governments and pharmaceutical industries to make sure vaccines are available and accessible to all. On Tuesday, the UK became the first Western country to start distributing a COVID-19 vaccine to its population.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use and have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst, inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity, but also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
More than three quarters of California's population are now living under the harshest lockdowns in the United States, as COVID-19 cases hit record levels in the country's most populous state. Regional stay-at-home restrictions went into effect for nearly 23 million residents in Southern California, and 4.4 million residents in a large swathe of the Central Valley on Sunday night, as ordered by the California Governor Gavin Newsom. The orders take effect on a region-by-region basis when hospital intensive care unit beds in the region drop to below 15%. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Vivian Ho and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Millions of Californians Put Under Strict COVID Lockdown. Stay with us for more of Vivian Ho and Martin Pengelly's article. More than three quarters of California's population are now living under the harshest lockdowns in the United States, as COVID-19 cases hit record levels in the country's most populous state. Regional stay-at-home restrictions went into effect for nearly 23 million residents in Southern California and 4.4 million residents in a large swathe of the Central Valley on Sunday night, as ordered by California Governor Gavin Newsom. The orders take effect on a region-by-region basis when hospital intensive care unit beds in the region drop to below 15%. The Southern California region and the San Joaquin Valley region joined five counties in the San Francisco Bay Area region, where local leaders preemptively ordered its 6 million residents to enter lockdown starting at 10 p.m. on Sunday, 6th of December. We cannot wait until after we have driven off the cliff to pull the emergency brake, said the Santa Clara County Health Officer, Dr. Sarah Cody. The restrictions, which require people to stay home and minimize contact with other households, will remain in place for at least 3 weeks, covering the Christmas holiday. All retail stores can stay open, although at 20% capacity, along with outside spaces such as parks and beaches, but restaurants and hair and nail salons and tattoo shops are required to close. California reported 24,735 positive cases in the last 24 hours, bringing the average to 21,924 cases of coronavirus infection a day. The state had a 10.5% 7-day positivity rate, meaning that in the past week, 1 in 10 Californians tested for coronavirus came back with positive results. California Governor Gavin Newsom noted that the rate of growth on the state's positivity rate was very, very acute. Just 30 days ago, the state's positivity rate was at 3.4%. Health officials believe the numbers will only get worse before they get better. We know that those cases that potentially occurred around people's dinner tables, activities, plans, travel through Thanksgiving are going to show up right about now. We're going to be seeing that for many days to come, said Dr. Mark Galley, California Secretary of Health and Human Services. Dr. Mark Galley added, we believe that the level of transmission that we've been reporting so far will likely continue to go up sometime because of those activities. Across the United States, 101,487 people were being treated in hospital with COVID-19 on Sunday, 6th of December, according to the COVID Tracking Project, and an additional 1,138 deaths were recorded. California has recorded more than 1.3 million cases, setting a new daily record on Sunday, with 30,075. Hospitalizations have topped 10,000 in a 72% increase over the past 14 days, with more than 2,300 patients in intensive care unit care. The 11-county Southern California region, which includes Los Angeles and San Diego, had only 10.9% of intensive care unit beds available, the state reported on Monday, 7th of December. The figure was at 6.3% for the San Joaquin Valley, a dozen counties in the Central Valley and rural areas of the Sierra Nevada. Together, the two regions are home to more than half of California's 40 million population. Surging cases and hospitalizations are not letting up, said Dr. Salvador Sandoval, the public health officer for the city of Merced. I can't emphasize this enough. Everyone must take personal steps to protect themselves and to protect others. The surge in cases has overrun the hospital capacities of more rural regions of California in particular, such as San Benito County, which is included in the San Joaquin Valley region and is under lockdown. Our only hospital in San Benito County is completely full, said Dr. David Ghilarducci, the San Benito County Public Health Officer. Dr. Ghilarducci added, this is an alarming situation that could get much worse. We can only get through this if we work together. Please follow our advice to keep yourself, your family, and your neighbors safe. Other regions of California, the Greater Sacramento, Northern California, and San Francisco Bay Area, range between 20% to 28% in capacity. But health officials in five of the San Francisco Bay Area's 11 counties adopted the state stay-at-home order for San Francisco, Santa Clara, Marin, Alameda, and Contra Costa counties, as well as the city of Berkeley, which has its own public health department, saying they could not afford to wait. Our biggest fear all along, that we won't have a bed for you or your mother or your grandmother or grandfather when they get sick, is the reality we'll be facing unless we slow the spread of the virus, said London Breed, San Francisco's mayor. The San Francisco Bay Area order will last at least through to 4th of January, a week longer than the state timeline. The new shutdowns were a gut-wrenching move for small businesses. Michelle Saunders-James was in tears on Friday at the thought of closing down her Oakland nail salon just 5 weeks after reopening. We wear face shields, we take temperatures, we do everything we are told to do so everyone feels safe, including our staff and our team, she told KGO-TV. So I don't understand why it's not enough, and I'm terribly sad and afraid. We know that these various restrictions are a hardship for people, Dr. Galley, California Secretary of Health and Human Services, said on Monday. It's not what we expected at this time of the year, but we know some of them are required to make sure we get through the surge as quickly as possible, and in saving as many lives as possible and in preventing as many infections as we possibly can. Other states are also struggling. In Arizona, on Saturday, the top public health official reported a near record of nearly 6,800 new coronavirus infections. Telling people to wear face masks around anyone outside their household, even those you know and trust. We must act as though anyone we are around may be infected, Dr. Kara Christ wrote on Twitter. On Sunday, 6th of December, Virginia reported a record number of cases for a second straight day with 3,880. Virginia has reported a total of 255,053 coronavirus cases with 4,200 deaths. Iowa saw an additional 35 deaths on Monday, 7th of December, continuing its high level of deaths during the pandemic. Despite the grim outlook, however, hope is on the horizon. A vaccine developed by Pfizer could be given emergency use approval this week. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced on Monday that California is preparing to receive more than 2 million doses of the vaccine in December. On Sunday, Dr. Moncef Slaoui, the chief scientific advisor to the federal Operation Warp Speed Vaccine Development Program, told CNN's State of the Union program that, in his opinion, the vaccine's effectiveness could last for many, many years, with older people and others more vulnerable requiring a booster every 3 to 5 years. Dr. Slaoui also said it was not known if vaccinated persons could spread the virus and said there may be an initial indication on that sometime in February or March. Dr. Slaoui added, "The continuing unknowns made it important for people to remain cautious and take safeguards to protect themselves and others against COVID-19. Once 70 to 80% of the population was vaccinated, he said, the virus will go down. On NBC's Meet the Press program, the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, Dr. Deborah Birx, said, "The vaccine's critical, but it's not going to save us from this current surge. Only we can save us from this current surge."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
From London, hello everyone. My name is Saeed Forza. Our top story this hour. With time running out for a trade deal with the EU before December 31st, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is holding crunch talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen over dinner in Brussels to try and break the impasse in negotiations. The two leaders are expected to discuss the major sticking points, including fishing rights, state aid, and dispute resolution. The meeting comes a day after EU chief negotiator Michel Barnier warned chances of a deal were very slim. Wading into the Brexit squabble, Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey has warned that failure to secure a deal would leave more lasting scars on the British economy than the coronavirus pandemic. Let's speak about that with Jonathan Fryer. He is an author and political commentator joining me now. Good to have you with us. Let me begin by asking you the question that's on everybody's mind. Is a deal still possible? Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, seems to suggest that there is a good deal out there to be made.
Well, things are absolutely on a knife edge at the moment. As you mentioned, Boris Johnson is going to have a dinner meeting with Ursula von der Leyen this evening, and therefore there are signs that a deal is possible, but it's not particularly likely at the moment, unfortunately. And in fact, in the House of Commons earlier today, the Prime Minister was really quite belligerent in his stance, saying that there was no way he was going to allow Britain to be ineffectively pushed around by the EU and to be made to follow EU rules now that we are outside the European Union. So it's on a knife edge, but it's not looking particularly good at the moment.
It sure doesn't. We've also heard the German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying they are ready for a no deal as well. Let's also talk about the UK economy, if we may. The government here says they're ready to crash out without a deal. The Bank of England governor, as I just read, begs to differ. Who are Britons to believe, really?
Well, I think in this particular case, they should be listening to the governor of the Bank of England, because what will happen with a so-called no deal crash out on 1st of January would be that we then move on to trading on WTO terms, which means the slapping of tariffs on all sorts of goods in both directions to and from Britain and the European Union. And some of those tariffs are extremely high, which would make some of the British produce commercially unviable and indeed would disrupt cross-channel trade appallingly. So it's a very bleak prospect indeed if that's what we end up with.
And after this dinner this evening between Johnson and von der Leyen, Boris Johnson is speaking for the UK. What about Ursula von der Leyen? Will she have to take the result of this meeting to the 27-member bloc, the heads of state, and tell them what the outcome has been, and then for them to make this a decision on that?
She will indeed. I mean, she has taken over from Michel Barnier, the chief negotiator, to underline the importance and the urgency of the situation. There is a council meeting of the leaders of the EU27 tomorrow in Brussels, running into Friday, and that's really the last chance for this to go ahead. So what she says, what she tells them tomorrow is are absolutely vital. But it's not just Germany that's preparing for a no deal. Ireland has been doing so for several weeks already, and certainly the mood music in Brussels amongst the EU27 is pretty gloomy tonight.
All right, Jonathan Fryer, thank you very much. Now, UK regulators have warned people with a history of significant allergic reactions against receiving the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for COVID-19. The advice came only hours after two hospital staff members who received the jab on the first day of the UK's mass immunization program suffered an allergic reaction. But both individuals are reportedly recovering after receiving treatment. The UK became the first country in the world to approve the Pfizer vaccine just last week, with care home workers, hospital patients, and National Health Service staff getting the jab ahead of others. On that topic, global organizations say 90% of people in dozens of poor countries will miss out on the COVID-19 vaccine. They say rich nations have already snatched up more than 2 billion doses. That's almost all of the world's current supply. Meanwhile, countries subject to Western sanctions say rich nations are already using their control over supply and demand as a political weapon. Bianca Rahimi has this.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use and have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
These countries represent 14% of the global population, but they have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population 5 times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity, but also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
All right, let's talk about that story with Dr. Ranjit Bharara. He is an NHS consultant, a physician and surgeon, joining me now. Pleasure to have you with us, as always. We just heard Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, speaking of equitable access to everyone, but his country is top of the list of countries that have been hoarding all these vaccines. In his case, enough to immunize every Canadian 5 times over. Is there a way to ensure that these hoardings won't happen? There's a fair distribution of the vaccines across the world.
Saeed, fantastic to be back with you. I think this is another classic case of the pandemic holding up a mirror to the globe and showing it as it really is, and the disparity between the words and deeds of the very richest nations. Our governments, you know, the plutocracy in the City of London may talk about human rights normally as cover for a bombing campaign to steal the resources of another country. I'm afraid when push comes to shove, you see the same distribution in terms of energy resources. And really, we have to worry whether these are in fact the best vaccines. I think the fact that the vaccine of Pfizer-BioNTech can only be stored at minus 70 degrees C, the fact that it's so expensive means that it won't be the vaccine that will answer the global problems. And I think it's increasingly likely that the countries across the world will instead look to those more stable and cheaper vaccines offered on a preferential rate, as Xi Jinping said, as a global human good from China and Russia.
Not only that, we have to take 2 doses of it too, 21 days apart. The global rollout is also being hampered by countries in the West using this as yet another political tool. Your reaction?
I think if you look at the global rollout, the fact is that really the only published data for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is a first interim analysis covering only a minority of their 44,000 patients enrolled in their trial. It's a large trial, but it's a tiny number of patients relative to the number who are now going to be injected. So 40 million doses have come to the UK, 800,000 already are being rolled out. I'm likely to be one of the people offered that. The elderly and the NHS are the first people in line. But actually, you know, there won't be enough doses. Even 1.2 billion doses is only enough for 600 million people, a small proportion of the world. But in fact, Said, I think the point to come to again and again is that this won't be the vaccine offered to the vast majority of the peoples of the world. And that's probably for the best, because actually those that have been taking it in China, probably a million people, have shown it to have a better efficacy and a better safety profile.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we've also heard of some allergic reactions being experienced by a few who have taken it. Will this raise any further questions about how quickly this vaccine was approved for use?
I think it has done, and you can see that MHRA are trying to do a damage limitation exercise. It is the case, okay, that we will see allergies with almost any medication. Penicillin is very common allergies, but we still use it. So I think probably it's still the case that the benefit outweighs the good, but it's hard to fully assess that when, as I say, and I hate to stress the point again and again, we're talking about a first interim analysis, not a lot of data. And really, I'm willing to participate. I will take the vaccine, but we don't have a choice as to which vaccine we have. But it is really a larger stage in a phased trial, and more information will come out about the safety profile over the coming days and weeks, Said.
Dr. Ranjit Brar, an NHS consultant, physician and surgeon, thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Let's see what's been trending in the social media world. Story one. A recent report by the Casa War Project at Brown University in the U.S. state of Rhode Island claiming the number of Afghan civilians killed in U.S.-led airstrikes has increased by 330% since a 2017 decision by the Trump administration to relax the rules of engagement for airstrikes against the Taliban. More now with Robert and Lakesh. And Robert, the U.S. military has refuted this report as one-sided. Tell us why we shouldn't believe it.
Well, what we can see by looking at the statistics and the raw data that we've been presented with is that just last year alone, 900 civilians only in Afghanistan were killed as a result of these airstrikes. If you're going to talk about one-sided, well, we could discuss the U.S. media and how it discusses the war in Afghanistan, which has gone on for 19 years. There's no objective there. It's an unwinnable war. Why are they there? And they get angry when Trump even talks about pulling out troops. But what the real sticking point is here is that we saw under Obama, Obama was known as the sort of drone king because he upped drone strikes by tenfold from what George Bush had done in his days. And of course, George Bush is known by many as a war criminal, and that's what he represents to a large portion of the world. But Obama upped that. From this as well, now we've got a 330% increase last year. Again, 700 civilians just in Afghanistan, just that we know about, having been killed just in airstrikes. And these drone strikes, we know, kill overwhelmingly civilians. And they've used these drone strikes as a means of trying to force and coerce the Taliban into discussions. And I mean, if we're talking about terrorist forces inside of the Middle East, they discuss the Taliban all the time, but according to this report, we know that most of the political violence has been initiated by the United States itself.
Well, let's hear some online reaction to this story, Robert.
The first one we have here says it's okay, Biden will go back to doing all the things Obama did that you got mad about Trump doing. Drone strikes, kids in cages, bailouts, etc. The media won't mention it, and we'll see posts of this VP appearances on nightly comedy shows. All will be perfect. You can go back to sleep. And we've got another one here as well saying Trump's escalation of drone strikes in Afghanistan, Middle East, and Africa really puts the lie to his being called an isolationist anti-war president.
Let's move on, Graber, to your second story quickly. The UAE importing goods produced in illegal Israeli settlements. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, this development has indicated to us all and really confirmed that the UAE so-called peace deal, as it was announced, is nothing to do with peace. It's about weapons deals to the United Arab Emirates. It's about the United Arab Emirates and Israel and the United States as well coming closer together in terms of their military cooperation and their economic cooperation as well. That's another big key part of this. And we're seeing that. Even the United Arab Emirates have gone forward with buying up a large portion of a team based in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, an Israeli team, which in its chants and in one of its songs actually insults the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So, of course, this would make them complicit in the crimes which are being committed and egging on illegal settlements.
And, Robert, how has this story gone down online among Palestinians, Palestinian rights activists?
Well, everyone is outraged, as you'd expect. The first one we've got here says UAE Sheikh Hamad Nayan bought 50% stake in Israel's most fascist football club, Beitar Jerusalem. Beitar is a Zionist settler project and has never fielded an Arab player. Often chants shameful words about the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and burying Arabs. And then we've got another one here from an activist, CJ Worldman, who says Israel is fast-tracking thousands of new illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank, just like the UAE, Bahrain, and the other traitors said wouldn't happen.
Just like they said it wouldn't happen. Robert Inlakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And now we move on. The UN Refugee Agency says more than 80 million people are displaced across the globe at the moment, people forced in record numbers from their homes by violence, persecution, and the pandemic. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a global ceasefire back in March to help the fight against the pandemic. However, Western-backed violence in Syria, Yemen, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, and Somalia continue to drive the numbers of refugees. Africa's central Sahel region also saw significant new displacements. The pandemic has also hit traditional corridors used by refugees, forcing people to flee in increasingly dangerous circumstances. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has met his Polish counterparts to discuss their common stance on the EU coronavirus recovery fund. Poland and Hungary are currently blocking the 1.8 trillion euro stimulus package in opposition to a clause linking the release of funds to EU rules on democratic reforms, which they say threatens their sovereignty. EU leaders will try to resolve the dispute at a summit starting Thursday. An EU diplomat has been quoted as saying that if the EU receives no signal that Poland and Hungary will drop their vetoes, it will be forced to go ahead without them. Let's look at two more stories that have been trending on social media. Story one in this segment, U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's nominee for Secretary of Defense, retired General Lloyd Austin, who will become the first black leader of the Pentagon, if confirmed. Richard Sudan joins me now with a quick analysis and the online reaction to that story. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. Yes, very interesting story over in the U.S. Now, as you rightly said, Lloyd Austin has been tipped President-elect Joe Biden's latest pick for the cabinet. And in a nutshell, this guy is a highly decorated former Army general. He was active until 2016, and he oversaw and led and commanded military units in Iraq and Afghanistan, which, of course, most people around the world actually view those wars as illegal. So on the one hand, he's being heralded, obviously, for being the first black person to lead the Department of Defense. But here's the interesting thing. Austin actually sits on the board of directors at Raytheon. Now, Raytheon is a multi-billion-dollar worth arms manufacturer and lobbyist, which works in Washington, and they essentially lobby for wars. Mm-hmm. And they've had a leading hand in causing much death and destruction around the world. And so now you have somebody tipped as the next defense secretary in the United States, essentially has been profiting from a company which has a massive hand in devastating wars in the Middle East and elsewhere. So people are rightly flagging this up, and people are actually making more of the fact of this man's war credentials rather than the fact he'd be perhaps, the first black person to lead the...
Right, perhaps defense is not the right word for that department, Richard. Let's have a look at the online reaction.
Sure, let's go to Sen Malavi, first of all, who says, Biden's defense secretary, Pete Lloyd Austin, has been on the board of directors of arms company Raytheon since 2016. Trump's defense secretary until last month, Mark Esper, was a vice president of Raytheon. This is the true face of capitalism. And anti-imperialist Front says, Biden elects Lloyd Austin as secretary of defense. He is a board member of Raytheon, the company which sells bombs to Saudi Arabia to destroy Yemen.
Well, let's move on to your second story, Richard, and how New Zealand security agencies failed to prevent last year's terrorist attack on two mosques in the country.
Right, so New Zealand and the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, are reacting to the findings of an inquiry, which Jacinda Ardern...